This is a Media Lab podcast. Welcome to Putting It Together, the podcast that goes through the entire body of work of Stephen Sondheim, show by show and song by song. My name is Kyle Marshall, your self-described Sondheim expert. This is the very last, like, official episode in the Pacific Overture season. There is a bit of a bonus episode that we're going to be doing next week, but for all intents and purposes, this is the last episode, for a while at least, that we're going to be talking about Pacific Overtures. And we're going to focus on all the different recordings that are available to the public to listen to, which by my count is three of them. And I have invited on a very special guest, Colin Molloy, who lives all the way over in the UK. I just phrase that as if it's like Narnia that we're talking about, which for a lot of people, the UK is. But he himself is a composer, dramaturge, and has some great insights with the recordings that we're going to talk about here. And really, there's not any good reason to delay it any further. So let's get into the show and talk about all the recordings of Pacific Overtures. Colin Molloy, thank you so much for coming back.
Thank you for having me. How are you?
You know, I'm doing okay. I have spent now the last 2.5 months, I think, talking about Pacific Overtures. Hilariously, I have been planning the Sweeney Todd season, and I have just realized that that's going to take me 7 months to go through the entire show. So it's going to be a pretty big undertaking.
So this feels like a breeze, a walk in the park.
I could do two Pacific Overtures inside of Sweeney Todd. That's how long it's going to take.
My Lord.
But how are you?
I'm not too bad, thanks. I'm very excited to be talking about this. I don't know if you know this. I think this is probably my favorite Sondheim show.
Yeah.
I know that it's very hard to pick one, and it does change maybe every few years or so, but this one seems to be sticking to the top of the list for whatever reason. I don't know why.
That's a great segue you just offered me, because I find that Pacific Overtures is one of those shows that a lot of people come late to inside of their Sondheim fandom. But then, depending on the type of personality you have, it either remains like, that was fine as an experience, or this is one of my favorite shows. It doesn't seem to be much middle ground to this show very much. So why Absolutely. Is it one of your favorites, or is the favorite?
I was trying to recall how I came about first experiencing it. And I think I managed to watch a bootleg of it on YouTube when I was maybe 17. I don't think this was the full one. I think it was in part 10-minute chunks, and it was, you know, 1 of 30, 2 of 30. And I think I sat there with Finishing the Hat trying to follow it. It was so grainy as well, I remember.
There's a better version on there now.
There is. But I remember at the time just thinking, what the hell is this? I love it, but I don't get it, and I want to get it. So there was that. And then I think through sheer persistence of, I think I then subsequently got the cast recording and listened to it on repeat. For whatever reason, I ended up writing about it for my dissertation when I was doing my undergrad, and really grew to love it. And
what was the dissertation about specifically? Was it an argument of some kind?
Strangely, it was about Sondheim's whole kind of output, but I was using Pacific Overtures as a case study for, I think I was writing about him as a dramatist or a dramaturg, and saying that Pacific Overtures is the paradigm example of this, which is, again, ironic. I'm now doing dramaturgy as a master's, but that's a side point. So that was the general idea. But I also, at the same time, then went to New York at the same time to go and see the classic stage, or whatever it's called, the John Doyle revival that was done a few years ago. So that's kind of how that all happened. I think I saw a Fringe production a few years before that as well. That's a very convoluted answer.
I mean, the couple things there. Can I just say how much I love just envisioning you as a 17-year-old being like, I'm super into Pacific Overtures. Like, it's I mean, this is going to sound so rude, but if you want to envision like the pretentious like theater kid, like that is like prime example. But I what I'm actually even more curious about, because you have, you know, gone to school, you have actually written, you know, your own music. How do you feel about the approach that this show takes? Like, really, rather than there being characters, it's ideas that are kind of being explored here, like using characters sort of, but it that's really the side point to this show, other than like this big idea of like history and like these two superpowers meeting. Would that be a challenge you would want to embark on yourself?
Oh God. It's kind of very anti-musical, isn't it? There's no real character that wants anything. I think I would be so terrified by having to write something like this if I was roped in on something. But I'm sure I read somewhere that all of them were kicked dragging and screaming into this project.
Yeah.
And they were all at the height of their powers and somehow they managed to come together.
Yeah, I mean, just as a quick little side note to that before we continue on, that is an element that we haven't really mentioned a lot on this season of the show. But yeah, from my understanding, you know, like John Wideman had this play, Harold Prince sees it, he thinks, of course, this would make a great musical. But then he had to super convince Sondheim to even be a part of this. And also convince Wideman that this should be a musical in the first place. So, and then they went with it once they all agreed.
Yeah, and I think there are loads of really fun caricatures in that. And I don't mean that to diminish the character writing, but there are loads of, I think I would love to be, if it were at all appropriate, which it isn't, I would love to be in a production of this, because I think there's so much fun to be had in playing small parts that come on and say two lines or anything. And I think there are definitely small people that want small things throughout the show. There are kind of small little vignettes, which is, I think that's what keeps the motor of this whole show going along the whole backdrop of the history. I think the big character, you're right, is history, or America v. Japan, in a sense. Right.
Because you are also one of the few people who have seen an actual production, like in a theater, what were your impressions of the John Doyle version?
This is a really weird anecdote, but I think around the time I was writing this dissertation and I saw this production, I got into review writing and I wanted to write reviews for a blog. And they kind of said, well, would you mind sending in something? And you're so right about painting the picture of me being this kind of 17-year-old saying, I love Pacific Overtures. But I really did go into this production thinking, I'm going to rip it to shreds whether I like it or not and make this really snooty review that no one will ever see except this theatre blog. And I thought I would pull up a quote, which is not representative of how I feel. But I did all those years ago. I was younger then, after all. I did say about this production, much of the show conflates simplicity for scarcity, all in a half-hearted attempt to articulate the missing religiosity of the show, which is a really pretentious thing for me to say. But I think, looking back, I really did like that production. I think I had fallen in love with the original Broadway cast production, and John Doyle, in his very adventurous way, had nipped and tucked and taken Chrysanthemum Tea out. Mm. He'd made it one act, an hour and a half long. I mean, there were still incredible elements of Kabuki and no tradition in there, but I think for a young soul wanting to see the legit proper Sondheim on stage, that wasn't going to be it. But I think I look back now and think, actually, that was a very well-considered production. I don't think it's perhaps aged in ways that perhaps other English revivals have that we might perhaps talk about.
Yeah.
I think, like the 2004 Broadway revival, it's making great efforts to make Pacific Overtures a really accessible show to new audiences, young audiences, people who haven't experienced theatre before. So that's my way of saying, ignore what I said all those years ago. I didn't mean it. I wanted to be taken seriously.
Yeah. I have to be mean if people are going to take me seriously. You know, so two things. First, just as a follow-up, obviously this is a show that is not as revived as, say, like, you know, Company, Follies, a Little Night Music, a bunch of other Sondheim shows. Do you have a sense of why you think that is?
We could talk on a really commercial level about how the songs are 10 minutes long. There is no drunkard until next. All of those kind of little minor details that I think make something stick in your brain. But then for some reason, I find myself humming The Advantages of Floating in the Middle of the Sea because it's such a repetitive melody all the time. But I wonder if there's something in the presentational side of it, or just the amount of material, historical and kind of alien in the sense that it's perhaps new, that it's trying to get across. That's really hard for even the most adventurous theatre goer to interpret. I think it requires a lot of work from the audience is what I'm saying, which if you're up for that, I think it's fair game, but not everyone wants to go to the theatre and be tested, which is fair enough. But
no, yeah, I get it. But
is that a good answer?
No, I like that. It's slightly different than I think what some other people have answered for me. The more I think about it, and I could have said this already in a podcast, I'm so tired. I've been doing so many recordings, I've now forgotten what I've said and not said on tape. But for me, I think it's almost like the inverse issue that Follies has in some cases, where Follies needs to be, this is my own opinion, I should be very clear, but I think Follies works best as being like, we are showing you all the money we spent on this on stage, like opulence, which means you need to be in a bigger theater, which means you have to drive a lot of people there to help support the show. Whereas Pacific Overtures, I find, works way better in like a very small venue. But then you have to run for a longer time to get more people there to get the money back. So when we're talking about like the commercial theater, yeah, it's these two sides of the same problem. Like Pacific Overtures is never going to be like broadly popular. It just isn't. It's not something that like the majority of audience are going to be like, oh, I love Pacific Overtures. But then it also needs the money to then be put on in those smaller venues, which I think sometimes hurts it, because if you try and put it on too big of a space, then it just, I think, loses its charm a bit.
I think you're right. It doesn't really need much. It is, you boil it down, it's some kind of epic narrative story and songs that go with it. And the spectacle is more in the authenticity of Japanese theatrical techniques, if that's fair to say, rather than pouring money into it. I think you're right.
What other shows did you see when you went to New York?
I've got to get my dates right. I can't remember because I went before then, but I saw a really weird play called Chess Match Number 5 at a small theatre somewhere about John Cage and Marcel Duchamp having a chess match.
Amazing. Okay.
And I can't really tell you much more about that. That's all I remember happening. I saw the play That Goes Wrong. It was the kind of West End transfer. Mm-hmm. I knew some people in that. I was going to say I saw Dame Edna Everidge, but that was another time.
Okay.
But I'd happily see her again.
Yeah, she's great. You know, we can go all over the place here, but is there a specific song that you find you keep coming back to in Pacific Overtures?
Like Next.
Interesting. Okay, great. What about Next? Why Next?
I think I've been listening to a couple of the previous interviews you've done for this show, and your kind of running question throughout it is the meaning of Next, yay Japan, or oh no Japan. Yeah, and I think it was Will who said it's meant to be, what he thinks it's the kind of ambivalence of it's both or it's neither. And I think, which is endemic to Sondheim, I think. But I think that's what I love about Next in particular, is that it's such an aggressive song about it. Here is this force of Japan that was so insular, that is now so extroverted and world consuming. Yet at the same time, here are all of these wonderful statistics that brush under the carpet all of this bad stuff that has happened. And I think that when you're watching the original Broadway production and you see in the kind of last 90 seconds, all of these women in modern dress coming out on stage and they're wearing headphones and there's a big dance break and Patricia Birch's amazing Japanese choreography has been updated so that it feels more rock, quote unquote. There's something so euphoric about that. That's really so unsettling at the same time, for me at least. Yeah. Next for me. How about you?
Oh, I am so basic when it comes to this question.
Someone in a Tree.
Well, Someone in a Tree is like the one I keep coming back to. But honestly, and maybe this is just because I had the chance to talk with Alvin Ng like a month and a half before he passed away. I love Chrysanthemum Tea now. Like, it is just every time I listen to it, it's like, oh, like the syncopation and the wordplay on that is just so on point. And it makes me so angry that Sondheim wrote that in a weekend. Like, it just is like, how dare you be able to write this and just jot it off. So I like that. But honestly, like, if I was going to become like 17-year-old Colin, I would... I love you. I know. I'm starting to love poems. I think poems is like really great. Every time I listen to it, it's like, yeah, like the music is beautiful. I like how they bring the orchestra in, like in the middle of that song, how it starts sparse and gets like super lush. And I mean, within the show, I like the dramatic irony that they're having this beautiful moment together and they're going to go see this dead wife when they come
back. Absolutely. It's top notch, top tier stuff.
Going to break into the conversation very rudely here to let you know about some of the people and organizations that help this show continue to go. First thing out of the gate that I need to talk about is if you would like to help support this show for absolutely free, you can give a rating and review on whatever app you listen to podcasts in. That's greatly appreciated. And if you'd like to help monetarily, which will only help to grow and make this show better, you can do so over at our Patreon page. Please do not donate if it impacts you negatively financially. We do have a new patron this week, so thank you so much, Louis, or Louis. I don't actually know the proper pronunciation, I apologize, but becoming a new patron at actually the God That's Good tier, so we now have a quintet of people. So joining, I'm going to try and find this out before next week, but Louis, Louise, you join Jack, Todd, Carrie, and Witty in the God That's Good tier. You can find out more information over at patreon.com/puttingittogetherpodcast. And as of today, I have started to put in different, I guess, goals to look for. We are currently sitting at $142 per month, which is phenomenal. That's honestly more than I was anticipating when I started the Patreon. I thought it would just help with like hosting costs and stuff like that. But if we hit the $150 per month, what I am willing to do is then once every month, just right here in the main feed, is make a Sondheim adjacent episode. So any one of his collaborators, we can focus on a song or a production or whatever it is that the community over on Patreon votes to do. But that will happen once we get to the $150 tier. And then I have some ideas for later tiers after that. So if you want to join in and make that reality happen, that would be great. I should also point out that Putting It Together is a proud member of the Alberta Podcast Network, locally grown, community supported. The Alberta Podcast Network promotes and supports Alberta-made podcasts and connects their audiences with Alberta-based businesses and organizations. This episode of Putting It Together is brought to you by Park Power, your friendly local utilities provider in Alberta, offering internet, electricity, and natural gas with low rates, awesome service, and profit sharing with local charities. You know, winter is coming and energy usage for all Albertans will be increasing, so now is a great time for listeners to look at their utility bills and ensure that they are on the best plan. Albertans have a choice who they pay the utility bills to. Park Power is happy to provide free, no obligations comparisons. If you decide to switch providers, it's easy and you can feel good knowing you are supporting a local business and helping to give back to our communities with your utilities bills. Learn more at parkpower.ca. This week, we're also brought to you by the Alberta Podcast Network. So let's go and take a listen to one of our other great shows.
Hi, I'm Emily.
And I'm Brienne. And together we make Emily Missed Out, a podcast where Emily and I dig into the long list of films that Emily hasn't seen.
It's a very long list.
Totally long list. And help her catch up on all of the pop culturally relevant lines, characters, scenes, and tropes that she may have missed out on.
We're also a proud member of the Alberta Podcast Network. You can find us online at albertapodcastnetwork.com or wherever you find your podcasts. Join us for my pop culture education.
Yeah.
Well, let's get into it here then. Let's talk about some of these recordings. That is what our job is here today, is to go through all the different recordings of Pacific Overtures. From what I could tell, there is definitely like one-offs, like compilations and like concerts, cabaret recordings of individual songs that happen on multiple albums. But as like a, here is a full production of Pacific Overtures, there is only three that have been made, which is the original Broadway cast in 1976, the Broadway revival from 2004, and then the English National Opera version also from not 1994, Kyle, from 2004.
Are you sure? Can I correct you on that?
You can, if it is a different date.
I think it's 1987.
Oh, maybe Apple lied to me, because in the liner notes it says 2004, but that might be just when it was remastered, is probably what that
is. Sorry.
Okay, well, say it's 1987, because it sounds like it's from 1987, because that was what I was going to say. It's like, this does not sound like a 2004 recorded version of this show. All right, well, let's say it's from 1987 here, then.
Let's
just say it is. I forgot to write his name down, but if people go back in time to when we talked about A Little Night Music's recordings, this is basically because of, I think it was the head of CBS Records at the time, like, loved Sondheim, so he made it his mission to record every show that he did, or else I don't think anyone would have recorded this full cast. So kudos to him, because once again, I'm just going to say it, Sondheim is kind of blessed that all of his original casts have been recorded, which is not true for every one of his contemporaries. No. So we'll start at the beginning, the original Broadway cast. Just in general, how do you like this recording, Colm?
I like it a lot. I think, I mean, I don't know if we're rating things. It's a, I didn't know. I think for me, it's a 9 out of 10. It's pretty excellent. And I think for me as well, given that it's the first iteration, not that the original means anything, but I guess it has, they're there making it at the time. Yeah. And for me, that matters in a way. I guess it's a shame that it's truncated in a way.
Yeah.
Things like Advantages and Next. And I'm sure there are little bits of tweaking here and there.
Yeah, they take out certain verses for sure. The other big one, Chrysanthemum Tea, they don't have the person wailing in it, which I think ruins some of the comedy of that song too. But
completely gone, isn't it? Yeah, those little things, which they are little things, but you know, less is more, as they say.
That's right.
What do you think of it?
So here's the thing, and I'll be brutally honest. When I first listened to it, I was a little bit turned off by this recording. This was many years ago when I first listened to it. It is a bit scratchy. Like, and I don't know if that was just like, I don't know why that is. Like, if it was how it was recorded or just like the age of the tape that they've tried to like digitally remaster, that sort of thing. I have kind of learned to sort of love the grittiness of that recording. I think Mako is by far the best reciter that there's ever been. And there's, I'm so happy that they have certain recordings for him and how he read and said certain lines. To me, if there is a definitive, like that feels like the definitive performance there for me. But I think overall, this is probably now my favorite version of Pacific Overtures, which I would not have said actually at the beginning of this season. I would not have said that, but it's become my favorite recording because I just think those original orchestrations are just so, so good.
They are excellent. Yeah, I think you're right. There is something in Marco's voice that I can't hear in the same way in other reciters.
Yeah. I think that's probably was a conscious choice, like especially like B.D. Wong, right? Like, I'm going to use like a $10 word here, but B.D. Wong's reciter always feels so avuncular to me. Like, he's just like, I'm gently bringing you into this show, right? And like Mako, like, starts like, Nippon, like he just yells at you. It's like, this is what it is. And I'm going to like be like so in your face about it. But I think that makes it so much better talking about Next. We haven't released that episode while we're recording it, but in my recording of Next, what I mention is how depressed he sounds at the end when he says welcome to Japan. Like, he sounds so defeated, and no other reciter really feels that way. They kind of just state it. It's like, but no, he's done. He's like, welcome to Japan. And I don't know, it's just a great way to perform that line.
It's a great, I don't know, he has that great gravelly voice, and yeah. I wonder if there's that element of, I managed to see some English No Theatre about over 18 months ago, just before the pandemic. They were doing this thing in London where the Japanese embassy were bringing No Theatre over, and then they were getting translators to put English No alongside it. And there was something so hypnotic about the low gravelly. It's quasi-operatic. It's, it's so transfixing. And I think that's definitely what you get in the original as well, with his voice. You hang on every word.
100%. Shame that it's kind of truncated from its original form. Glad that it's available. I love a lot of the performances in there and the orchestrations.
Dreams are roaring, hope is filling, Next. Hope is roaring, new is filling, keep exploring, Next. Grab the thunder, just a murmur, a little thunder, Next. Let the wonder, see our pretty, going under, what a pity, Next. Dreams of flying, use the potion, Next. Dreams are crying, mix the potion, dreams are dying, ride the ocean.
with the Broadway revival from 2004?
I'm already assuming what your thoughts are going to be, but I think we've had the inverse reaction. So I don't think I used to like this cast recording very much at all. I think for the reason that, despite the fact, I think I'm right in that this is also orchestrated by Jonathan Tunick, but it's just a new orchestration.
As far as I know, yeah.
I think the fact that it sounded so different to the original, I think I was so thrown by it. It took me a long time to get into this recording.
Right.
It's so clean and it's so pristine in its delivery, and you can hear every word, and it does feel like it's been recorded for a listening at home experience, which is so unlike the other one. But actually now that I've listened to it so much, it's so great. And I really love the fact that it's this brand new take on this. Yeah. And I'm so thankful for it. Trying to think if, I mean, it's not complete, but it's as complete as it could
more
get, really.
Complete, yeah.
Yeah, I think it's brilliant. I'm going to guess that you love this one.
I do like this one quite a bit too, but this is one of the very few examples of this. In fact, I don't know if this might be the only Sondheim example of this for musical theater where this revival is the first time, like the first recording I ever heard. Normally I seek out the original cast, but for some reason, yeah, the Pacific Overtures was this revival cast that I first listened to. And so I think that's partly why, like, this was how I originally heard most of these songs in full for the first time. And so I think that influences a person, but the cleanness is appreciated. I do like the expanded talking bits. Although I do want to ask you broadly, because there is a lot of contention on that, you know, if you go to certain message boards about whether talking bits should be included on albums at all. But overall, I think that if you were brand new to Pacific Overtures, this is probably the album I would recommend people go to first and then broaden out from there. Just because the original does have that like level of like, this sounds old, which this one doesn't necessarily.
That's true.
And the performances are pretty good on it as well. So it's like, it's not a bad recording. I love it a lot, actually, but it's probably my second favorite out of the three.
No, I think you're right, though. And I guess those, I don't know if they're trolls on the message boards, but there probably is a point to be made that a cast recording shouldn't necessarily be the whole show on tape. It needs to serve a completely different purpose, which is to make the score or make the show a listenable piece rather than a purely visual piece. So having all of the dialogue in there isn't actually going to be hugely helpful.
Yeah.
In the same way that dovetailing little bits is more helpful than actually just having the songs like the original, which I think if you gave that to any passerby, they probably would think, how the hell am I meant to get into this? You've not given me any context whatsoever.
That's the thing. I think people sometimes forget that a lot of people's first introduction to a show is through the album. And so I think you do need to make it a little bit clear to an audience who's just listening to it as an audio medium, like what is actually happening. So I actually don't mind like lead ups. I don't need like entire like 5 minute tracks of talking on it. But like as a lead up, it's like, okay, this sets the scene. I understand what's going on. Or you do something completely different. Have you heard about this show called Ride the Cyclone?
Haven't. Why haven't I?
I don't know. I would check it out. I'm not going to guarantee everyone will like it, but it's actually started in Canada, which is how I know about it. And Transfer to Off-Broadway for a bit. Anyways, they've been retooling it over and over again. It's a pretty wild idea. It's actually based on a true story, kind of these people who went to an amusement park where there's rides and stuff like that, and they were killed on the cyclone ride.
Oh, my God.
And so the play takes place as far as like these children, teenagers, basically singing a song before they get to go to heaven. It's kind of like Cats, I guess. but the there's a narrator, like someone who frames a story, which is this like the mechanical tells your fortune thing.
Oh, if you ever seen amazing.
The movie, have you ever seen the movie Big? Is like that idea of like that sort of thing. This is so much backstory that people don't need for context. But so yeah, definitely check out the album. It's interesting. Why I'm bringing that up is that on the recorded album that was just actually released like a month and a half ago or a couple months ago, they intentionally don't tell you what happens. They actually change the story for the recorded album so that when you go and see it in person, you're not spoiled on what the actual ending is.
Hello, I am the amazing Karnak. I was designed to predict the exact time and place of someone's death. So you already know you're in for a good time. And welcome to the Ride the Cyclone album, where through my years of prognostication, I've realized that the only thing that makes less money than theater is releasing an album on a streaming service. Yes, this is the talking part of the album that you will remove from the playlist in future rotations. Or perhaps you are listening to this on a vinyl record and have to go through the painstaking process of skipping this track manually, all because of your absurd insistence that sound technology has not progressed since the year 1877. Eventually, you will resign yourself to sitting through this talking part multiple times, weeping openly in the fetal position, one step closer to that realization that free will is just the fridge magnet, and we live briefly in a cold, unfeeling, deterministic universe in an abandoned warehouse called time.
And they do that intentionally. It's like, hey, this is an audio medium. You can't see what's going on. So go and see the show if you want to know what happens. Like, he actually states out very plainly how they're changing the album for the audio experience. So you could do something like that, too, if you wanted to like be funky in your recordings.
Yeah. I guess there's thinking of it as either a literal translation to audio or as a means of adapting something for audio. Yeah. I guess that's the distinct difference that happens in this case.
I think I fall more on the adaptation piece. I think you should adapt it slightly. Like, you don't have to change things like the Ride the Cyclone does, but you do have to think, like, how do I have to slightly change these things and fit them together so that if someone is listening to this for the first time, they understand what's going on and they aren't left out in the cold.
In the middle of the world we float, in the middle of the sea, the realities remain remote, in the middle of the sea. Kings are burning somewhere, wheels are turning somewhere, trains are being run, wars are being won, things are being done somewhere out there, not here. Here we paint screens. Yes, the arrangement of the screens.
So that is the revival. So how about this English National Opera version that you claim is from 1987.
Oh, God, I hope that I'm right in that. The trolls are going to write in. Yeah. I used to love this one.
Interesting.
Perhaps back when I was more of a completist and wanting to hear the show from beginning to end at home was why I really used to like it. And I think now that I've come to love the show as a whole more and what it represents, I think actually the cast recording has... Well, it's problematic in a way, which perhaps we'll get to. But the things I am grateful for on it are that it's another chance to hear really good professional singers singing through this great score. You can hear the whole dialogue in its entirety. You can hear the underscore, which is stuff that is seldom included in cast recordings. And it's got the additional things like the lion's dance, which I don't think any of the others do.
Yeah, no, I actually wanted to bring that up specifically. That is the one thing that I love about this recording is that they do include that lion dance, which is actually a very important part of the show. Because it comes right after Someone in a Tree. In fact, this is like, you're giving me great segues today because I had someone write in about this very specifically because I mistakenly said they do Someone in a Tree and then it's the act break right afterwards.
How could you?
I know. So this is by Rob who wrote in, Someone in a Tree is the last song with lyrics in Act 1 of Pacific Overtures, but it's followed by The Lion Dance, a strange piece of music with sounds alternately very Japanese and very American. And it's not only the music. In the original production of Pacific Overtures, the actor was costumed or at least wore a wig as in traditional Japanese lion dance, but he's dressed like Uncle Sam, and the dance itself also includes Japanese and American styles. So every aspect of this piece is a blend of Japanese and American, which is a perfect way to end Act 1. And then, of course, I feel differently than some of your guests about the various aspects of the show, but I was surprised to hear that you say next was frightening. I don't think it played that way at all in any of the productions I've seen. It's always exuberant and, of course, being Sondheim, multi-layered and complex. What was frightening was the lion dance. So let's hear it for the lion dance. I don't want to like brush it under the rug, but it is because it is bringing in elements of like Please Hello. You can hear some of that scoring before you actually even see that in the show itself, which
Absolutely.
Is kind of cool. And I've seen a little bit of the dance display too. I can't remember if that's actually in that recorded version on YouTube now or if I just saw it by itself. Regardless, I've seen that performance done, and it is quite like, oh my gosh, what is happening?
Yeah, I think maybe frightening is more of a, it's startling in that there are, if there are masks, there are painted faces which obscure
right.
a genuine emotion for something perhaps more blunt. And again, it's mixing things together and making them fit, which is terrifying in a way.
That's right, that's right. Size of the Lion Dance, though, do you keep coming back to this recording?
I do, because I think it still has the original orchestrations,
right.
And I do genuinely like how the songs are performed from a kind of really boring, like from a tempi. I like the speed of the songs. It doesn't feel slow. It doesn't drag.
It does feel a little bit more. I mean, it's from the opera, I understand, like the National Opera, but it does sound a little bit opera-y inside of the performances.
Yeah, I think that's one of my gripes with it, along with the fact that the cast all sound and their names are very English, is that it does have this kind of hokey British putting on a Broadway musical,
right.
which is actually about Japan, if that's fair to say.
Well, no, that's fair to say. I mean, not to talk around it too much, but one of the criticisms of this production is the fact that it is an all-white cast rather than it being an all-Asian
cast.
For
sure.
And Sondheim and Weidman both actually came out against it being performed that way.
Good.
Yeah.
I agree.
And that's the weird juxtaposition that I find myself in, or paradox I find myself in, which is, I agree with you in the sense that, like, it's sung well. Like, they're not bad performers. Should they be the ones performing this show? No. But, like, yeah, they're singing it well.
Yeah, I think it feels... There's an article somewhere. I don't know if it's in the Sondheim Studies guidebook or whatever. I don't actually have that. There is a chapter on Pacific Overtism talks about this idea of othering, which people who aren't white are more prone to, I guess, experiencing in Western culture. And I think there is something that Pacific Overtures, as should be done with an all-Asian cast, does in a different way. It creates otherness in the white audience, which
right.
I think is a really, really important thing to do. And I think to make an all-white cast kind of misses the point as well. There is so much caricature that happens in the second act and stuff like Please Hello that I think is lost in a way. And I think there has to be that level of discomfort that is felt by us, mm-hmm. by you and me.
I will say, and I should have written down the gentleman's name, but whoever does the performance of the Gilbert and Sullivan pastiche nails it. But I mean, you've also had probably like 300 years of practice in your country.
Yeah, they're doing that on alternate days probably, aren't they?
Yeah,
Gilbert
yeah.
and Sullivan shows.
That's actually probably true from the National Opera.
Hello, I come with letters from Her Majesty Victoria, who, learning how your trading now sang Hallelujah Gloria, and send me to convey to you a positive euphoria, as well as little gifts from Britain's various emporia.
The man has come with letters from Her Majesty Victoria, as well as little gifts from Britain's various emporia.
Tea for drink. I see. I thank you. I think her letter do contain a few proposals to your emperor, which if of course he won't endorse will put her in a temper, or more happily should he agree will serve to keep her placid, or at least lie and follow by a permanent ambassador.
Treaty ported from the court of permanent ambassador. A treaty ported from the court of permanent ambassador. A treaty ported from the court of permanent ambassador and more.
So yeah, those are the three basic recordings. For me, I would probably, like, as the 1, 2, 3, would do like original, revival, and then the National Opera version is probably how I'd rate those. But I will say original Broadway cast and the revival are pretty close for me as far as my enjoyment level of them. I kind of like them for two vastly different reasons. I like the revival because I think the recording sounds better, but I like the Broadway cast recording because I think the performances are better. But that's kind of where I come down on it.
I mean, I'm going to sound like a broken record because I think my ranking is exactly the same and my reasons are exactly the same
sure,
as well.
Sure.
So yeah.
As far as like individual songs go, was there anything specific that you wanted to bring up from any of like the individual songs?
I hate you for asking this because it was so hard to see if I could pick a favorite from each one. I really wanted to, I guess if we're, I don't know if we are picking favorites, but yeah. I wanted to say advantages for the original, but because there are little bits that are cut, like the whole bow sequence, and
there are
bits towards the end of the song. I think there's like 16 bars before Marco says "we float." That's cut as well, and I happen to love that bit, so I vetoed that, and instead I went with "Someone in a Tree" for the original.
Sure.
But we won, no, you can't, and we won't, but we need it, and we won. Will you grant? If you don't, we concede it.
And we sat through the night, and they lit yellow tapers.
I was there.
For the sheer joy of it, and I think it is great. I know Sondheim has quibbles with the Warriors slightly Boston accent and saying I can hear them now.
Yeah.
But that doesn't bother me. So
yeah, for me the best song from the original cast is, for me at least, is Chrysanthemum Tea. Every time I listen to it, what I love the most, and maybe it drives other people nuts, I don't know, but for me I wish I knew instruments better, but it sounds like some sort of like synthesizer playing after, like ding tink a tink tink a tink, whatever that
I think it's like a synthesized harpsichord or something.
Yeah,
like
that's what. Oh, I think you're right, because I think Sondheim talks about the fact that he played a harpsichord at someone's house, and that's how he figured out how to create the music for this show.
Mind you, but you'll notice just behind you there are ships in the bay. They've been sitting there all day with a letter to convey, and they haven't gone away, and there's every indication that they're planning to stay, my lord. Have some tea, my lord, some chrysanthemum tea. It's an herb that's superb for disturbances at sea. Is the shogun feeling better? Good, now what about this letter? Is it wise to delay, my lord? With the days disappearing, might we benefit from hearing what the soothsayers say, my lord?
Anyways, that little weird plink-a-plink thing is, like, great. how about on the revival?
Oh, this was tough as well. I went with Please Hello. I think that's the cleanest recording of that, where you can hear every word.
Yes.
And actually, it wasn't until even a week ago that I clarified what the last few lines were when they're all kind of singing over each other.
Yeah.
I'm ashamed to say, because it actually is not very clear on the other recordings, and everyone is on fire, I think, in the Broadway revival. So that's why I went with that one.
It is late, and I fear, well, you see, there's a famine. Could you wait for a year? We'll agree to examine it. But late, I fear, there's a drought if had a famine. If you wait for a year, then don't look, it's a nod.
One million trees I've cut, these are shot in a nod.
These will wait, these will know, west is on fire.
Well, that will shake us forward to the
past. You might have faked a chance, I'm sorry, tell me.
Don't touch the count!
Hold it, tonk, hold it, tonk. They're what everybody wants, you should want. Hold it, tonk, makes a nation like a brother. We'll be here every year to protect you from each other, and to see you are in signing foreign treaties and détente.
Please hello, we must go, but our intercourse will grow through détente, as détente brings complete cooperation.
By the way, let me say, we adore your little nation, and with heavy cannon, wish you an ending. Please hello.
Before the internet, I'm so curious how people like figured out what people said sometimes, because you're right. There are some of those recordings, and especially Please Hello in the original. It's like, I really don't know what they're saying unless I had this, like when I had the Finishing the Half book, I'm like, oh, that's what they're saying. Okay, good. I can understand it now. For, honestly, for me, this is the one where I put poems down. I think it's so beautiful on that revival recording. I think it sounds so good. And for all the reasons I stated before, I just like how it starts sparse, gets lush, and then kind of goes back down to being kind of sparse with the woodblock at the end. So I like all that stuff.
Leaves, I love her like the leaves, changing green to pink to gold, and the change is everything. Sun, I see her like the sun, in the center of a pool, sending ripples to the shore, till my journey's end.
Your turn. Rain.
How about for the National Opera version?
I went for Next because it's complete with the dance breaks, except I think again for another few bars somewhere, but it's more or less completely there. And I don't know how you feel about the Broadway revival, but I know in Next there is
lyric changes.
And there's also a staging and I guess music change with bombs landing, which I guess is the implied Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
So people who have been keeping it is coming up technically from when we're recording this, but I'll reiterate it. I think where I come down on it, I prefer the original lyrics actually a lot more in this case for some great reasons that my guest Eric Stadnick points out, which is the original lyrics actually both celebrate and critique Japan, where the updated lyrics don't. They actually have just like random things that they talk about rather than be very pointed in the commentary that they're used for. So I think I do like the original lyrics better. I kind of like the bomb drop, to be honest with you. I don't know. A lot of people have, I've seen the criticism of being like, it's either A, too obvious or less slightly in poor taste. But where I come down on it is that if you were talking about American and Japanese relations specifically, it's almost weird not to mention the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. So I don't know. I can see why you would put it in there.
Fair enough. Yeah, I guess I fall into the obvious. It's implied in the lyrics, or it's implied in how perversely happy the affirmations of, and also how terrifying the affirmations of Next are. It's for me, but that's why I guess I went with that for the ENO.
The Tokaido Express, the world's fastest train, can now carry passengers along the royal route from Tokyo to Kyoto in 2 hours, 3 minutes.
Next spring, Mitsubishi will market video cassettes of cherry trees so that people may view the beauty of the cherry blossom in the comfort of their own homes.
Next!
In 1986, Japan's gross national product was 1/10 the world's total. In 5 years, it will be 1/5. And in 10 years...
Next!
I don't know if this is like cheating or not. I said honestly, the lion dance and all the underscoring bits is what I said were my favorite parts, because I do. I think they're great to include on the album, and I'm actually surprised that the lion dance
you
isn't
are
included.
Cheating.
Yeah. I'll say specifically the lion dance. I don't know why that hasn't been included on any of the other recordings. I don't know for sure if it was even in the revival, but it was in the original, so I don't know why it wasn't put in.
My guess is, this is me being a young millennial, thinking that maybe they just didn't have room on the record
probably
to fit it in, which is a shame because it's great.
Factual reasons. I want to make up a reason.
Dance stands.
That's right. That's right. Everyone's talking about the lion dance. But it's great. It is a great piece of music, though. I actually really do love it. Okay. Well, that is, I guess, all of the different recordings. Do you feel No, that's not the right question to ask. Do you think that we'll see another revival of Pacific Overtures anytime soon?
Oh, I really hope so. The John Doyle one really was very good. And I think I'm sorry that nothing came of it, because it was great whilst it was there. But I was surprised. I was looking at there's a Sondheim Guide website, which shows kind of all of the international productions of Sondheim shows. And there have been a fair few regional productions of Pacific Overtures throughout the Americas. But then also, I think there was a Japanese translated production in 2000. And I think that is the production I want to see. I think I'd love to see it in Japan. I don't know what that would do, but I'm curious to see it. It's had its Broadway run. It's been in the West End and it's been at the English National Opera. It's done off Broadway. It has done Japan, but I think it should be there again and speak to a 2021 audience.
Yeah, I think that there's ways to utilize that for sure. I guess I can only parrot what I have heard. So correct me, anyone can correct me if I'm wrong. But from what I understand, like that 1976 broadcast version that's on YouTube that was broadcast in Japan was kind of met with a bit of like confusion, because it's like, what is this? We don't know what this even is. But when it was developed by Japanese creators for a Japanese audience, that's when it apparently clicked in 2000. We're like, oh, okay, we get this. And apparently there's a big love for that show amongst theater fans over there, so which is cool to see.
Yeah, absolutely. But yes, I would like to see it. I'd love to see it in a really small... I mean, I saw it at the Union Theatre, which is this small fringe theatre in London, maybe... Mm-hmm. 5 years ago, that was the first production I saw. And I really didn't, I mean, I'm still getting to grips with what was going on. But I think now I would crave any production over another Sweeney. Hate on Sweeney, but
no, but,
you know.
But no, you get it. Like, it's like there's certain shows and like the non-Sondheim one that I can think of. It's like, oh, another Hello Dolly revival? That's bold. Yeah, of course, let's do it. but this is the one that I really, really just want to see a live production. So I'm on the hunt. It's like, is there anything that is doing this that's even close that I can get to? And not yet. So I'm hoping that at some point that'll change here for me. Anything else you want to bring up? Anything in your notes?
Oh, I don't know if I can shoehorn this in now, but it was when we were talking about The Othering. Oh, bollocks. Yeah, I have a quote that says, "The sense of tone and style that Sondheim sought stemmed at least in part from his dismissal of the exoticism of Rodgers and Hammerstein's Orientalist incursions in South Pacific and The King and I, both of which he suggested could have well have taken place in Brooklyn." I don't know. There's something interesting in that.
I think there is something interesting in that, and something that I don't think has been mentioned very often again in this season that I kept seeing reference to, is that the creative team for Pacific Overtures was very committed to not doing the Rodgers and Hammerstein treatment to this material. And again, it has to be noted, like, Oscar Hammerstein was like a father figure to Sondheim. So it wasn't out of like, I don't like his stuff. But I think it was more like the approach now is dated in 1970, and we have to try something different than what's been done in the past.
Absolutely. Sondheim seems like, even though he's 91, the kind of person who would think about making reasonable adjustments even now on what's the right way to approach this show in 2021. And we've got to be even more careful and appropriate with things like representation and who we get doing what role, whether it's on stage or off stage. So it's kind of following on more than anything, as well as rejecting past traditions.
Burn it all down is what I say. So I will say, normally what we do each season on the last episode of Talking About Songs is play a little game. And I forgot to do it this time. So I thought, like, well, I don't want to just not do it. And Colm is game enough to actually play along here with me. So are you ready to play How Many Tonys?
I'm so ready. I'm terrified.
I keep saying, no cheating. You can't cheat. But not that I could ever prove that you have or not. So a few different questions here. We're going to talk about the original Broadway cast here first. First question, how many Tony Awards was the original production of Pacific Overtures nominated for?
Nominated. My guess is 4. this is really bad that I should know all of this, being the anorak. I think it was nominated for Best Musical, Best Score, something like, oh, I don't even know if those were separate categories or whatever. Okay, I'm backtracking. I think it was nominated for 4 and won 1.
Let's take a look here. Because that was going to be my next question. How many do you think it won for? But it was actually nominated. You're wrong, actually, to say, on both counts.
Right. Brilliant.
Yeah. It was actually nominated for 10.
Oh, wow.
It was actually nominated for a lot. So
all the categories, basically.
Basically all the categories. So musical, book, score, leading actor for Mako, featured actor for Seo Sato, direction, choreography, scenic design, costume design, lighting design. How many do you think it won then if it didn't win 1?
Well, I know it didn't win Best Musical.
Do you know what did win Best Musical that year? That might help things out here.
Chorus Line?
You're right. Yes. Chorus Line won that year. In the same year of Chicago. Like, it was a pretty stacked season.
I know. Yeah. Something going on that year. Yeah. I want to say it won something for either scenic design or costume or both. Was it Boris Aronson?
Yes.
And I don't know who did the costume.
Florence Klotz. But you're right, Florence. Actually. Both of them won. So it was 2. It won 2 for costume,
yes,
and for costume and scenic design. So the awards it lost, and this is going to be saying the same thing over and over. Chorus Line won musical. Nicholas Dante and James Kirkwood won for a chorus line for a book. Marvin Hamlisch and Edward Kleban won for a chorus line for score. Sammy Williams won for featured actor for a chorus line. Director went to Michael Bennett. Choreography went to Bob Avian and Michael Bennett. Lighting went to Taryn Musser for a chorus line. The only one that isn't a chorus line is the best leading actor, who went to George Rose for a My Fair Lady revival. So that's who Mako lost to. Which, if you
want, shame.
I know. If you want to go down a terrible Wikipedia black hole, go look up how George Rose passed away, because it is awful. Just as an FYI to people. So for the revival, then, you know, in 2004, how many Tonys do you think it was nominated for?
No, now you're really testing me, because I don't know this at all. I'm gonna have to make.
Yeah, and there's certain categories revivals can't be nominated in. It's weird how they can be for some and not others. Anyways.
I feel like this was either the same year or maybe a year before as the Assassins revival.
It was definitely not the... Oh, I can't say that for sure. I don't think it was the same year, but they were close together.
Let's say nominated for 6.
You should have kept your original answer for the other one. It's 4. It was nominated for 4.
Okay.
It was nominated for Revival. It was the best revival. It Orchestrations for Jonathan Tunick. Best Scenic Design by Rumi Matsui. And Best Costume Design for Junko Koshino. How many do you think it won?
I don't know. I feel pessimistic. 1.
It won 0, actually. It didn't win a single one.
That's such a shame. And it wasn't even nominated for Best Director.
I know. This is the curse of Jerry Herman on Sondheim, because Best Revival that year went to Lacage aux Folles. That's who won Best Revival that year. But this was also the year for original musical, The Light in the Piazza, which basically cleaned up everything else, because that's who Orchestrations went to, Scenic Design went to, and Best Costume Design went to. Are you a Light in the Piazza fan?
I am, actually. Yeah. I'm a big Adam Gettle fan.
Yeah, me too. I like him a lot.
I like his scores. I think Piazza has book problems, but what musical doesn't have book problems?
Colm, thank you so much for joining me here today. If people wanted to stay in contact with you, see what you're up to, what are the easiest ways to do so?
Oh, well, you can find me on Twitter at @ColmMalloy_. I'm also on Instagram, if you happen to be a person that uses that. I don't really use it very frequently. I'm not a very social media person, but if people follow me, maybe I'll be more sociable. The Sondheim cryptic crossword thing went down a treat, so who knows? Maybe I just need another thread to get invested in.
You need to start making your own puzzles. That's the thing you need to do.
Oh, God. Okay, maybe. Maybe one day. Musicals are enough of a puzzle.
I know.
But other than that, I'm also on SoundCloud. I have a YouTube, and that's about it. I'm working on re-updating my website. We'll get there when I find time.
Yeah, honestly, the recurring thing for any artist, myself, well, I don't really call myself an artist, but I'll include myself for right now. It's like, it's like you make a website and then for the next 5 years, like, I really need to update that website until you finally do.
Yes. So I'm not saying my website at the moment until I've actually done the homework and updated my website. Mm-hmm. So watch this space.
that's right. Just put that, just put like under construction with those like little worker gifts and stuff like that.
Yeah, it'll be perfect. I'm gonna steal the domain at liondancestands.com right now.
Do it.
That's gonna be my new website.
Perfect. Thanks, Colin.
Thanks.
Thanks so much for listening. You can send emails to puttingittogetherpodcast@gmail.com. You can also follow Sondheim Podcast on Twitter and Instagram. And you can support the show on Patreon by going to patreon.com/puttingittogetherpodcast. Thank you to the Alberta Podcast Network and to Park Power this week. Putting It Together is available on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and pretty much anywhere you get podcasts from. Consider subscribing so that you never miss an episode. Next week, we will be talking about a song called I Never Do Anything Twice. The entire episode, I'll be wearing a habit. As always, a big thank you to the great Chris Taniguchi, who designed the podcast artwork, and Nick Driscoll for composing our theme music. Well, we've reached the end of our episode. Yes, I know. Goodbye for now.